Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the New Statesman's Hidden Histories podcast and our new series, The Great Forgetting, Women Writers Before Austen. Episode 6, The Great Forgetting. All women together ought to let flowers fall upon the tomb of Aphra Behn, for it was she who earned them the right to speak their minds. Those were the words of Virginia Woolf in 1929, 2.5 centuries after Behn's death, when a female writer was still considered an oddity. So how did the women poets, novelists, essayists and letter writers of the 18th century slip so easily out of the canon? Perhaps Alexander Pope's Dunciad, an attack on Grub Street and commercial writing we talked about in earlier episodes, gives us a clue. Here's his verdict on Eliza Haywood. See in the circle next Eliza placed two babes of love close clinging to her waist. The goddess then, who best can send on high the salient spout far streaming to the sky? Yes, she is judging a literal pissing contest between two publishers. Her sexual favours, it's implied, are also the prize. This week we'll be talking about attacks like that on women writers, as well as the more subtle process of canon formation and the attempt to make writing seem like an unsuitable job for a woman. We'll also ask, how different are things today when most novel readers are women, but men dominate the literary pages and the literary prizes? Sophie Colombo and Liz Edwards join me. And Sophie, I'm going to start with you. Mm-hmm. When did this great forgetting, which is a fine phrase and which we've nicked from someone.
Yeah.
So give him credit. His name is?
Clifford Siskin.
And it is, when did that process really start?
It's difficult to pinpoint it exactly. I mean, I think the point maybe we should start from is that actually rampantly misogynist and anxious for their masculinity as they were, many of the reviewers and male writers of the 18th century are not to blame for this. They were not forgetting these women. They were not sidelining them. These women had no problem achieving fame in their own day.
And I guess the other thing to point out, which I never really grasped until recently, is that, you know, you have this idea that because George Eliot and, you know, the Brontes had to write under male names, you sort of assume, well, maybe no one knew about women, that women writers were women. But these women were, some were anonymous, mm-hmm. like Frances Burney, but lots of others published under their own names, didn't mm-hmm. they?
Absolutely. Yeah, anonymity is a massive thing in the 18th century, and it's been shown recently in a fantastic statistical project that, you know, I think it's something like 3/4 of novels in the late 18th century were published anonymously. But some do use their own names, and what this means, this huge figure of anonymity, is that where women do use their own names, you can say a real attempt to, you know, write your name for posterity there, a real attempt to brand yourself otherwise. So that takes on extra meaning. I mean, at some point in the 19th century, moving into the 20th, these women start to be written out. Burney might be a bit of a good illustration here. I mean, she's incredibly popular right up until, you know, sort of 1814 when she publishes her final novel. And the reviews of that novel start to take on very, very misogynist undertone. I think it's John Wilson Croker, one of the most influential reviewers of the period, says of her latest novel, "This is Evelina, but Evelina grown old and haggard, the lips withered, you know, etc., etc." So, you know, you can see how he's binding up her physical body with her book in that way, and saying, you know, you were good when you were young, your early work was it, but now, you know, this more mature work is, you know, not doing it for us. And then as you kind of move through the 19th century, Burney becomes famous as a diarist. They start to say, well, it's her observations of Dr. Johnson really that are of value, not her own fiction. You get through to the early 20th century and suddenly she's Fanny Burney. She's kind of frozen in this, you know, young girl observing the male greats and writing her diary sort of image. And then by the time you get to Ian Watts, he's sort of saying, oh, she's, you know, in the 1950s, this is. He's saying, oh, she's, you know, she's a sort of footnote to Jane Austen. Jane Austen took a couple of themes, a couple of sort of images from her. And then after the 1970s, you get a reclaim. So that's a kind of, that's only one writer, of course, but I think it can serve as a sort of way to show how women's contributions, they can never be erased, that, you know, they can never be made to not happen, but they can be sidelined and moved out of the idea of literature or of the canon.
And Liz, how much did that, was that made easier by the forms and subjects that those middle of the 18th century writers wrote about? You know, they weren't writing Victorian state of the nation kind of novels, were they? Big broad sweeps about, you know, the purported to address universal themes.
Yeah, I think in that context, we need to think about what Ian Watt was responding to, which is not much before him, is the New Criticism, which I think would have been much more sympathetic to these big, broad themes of universal human experience, which
so
we might...
For those of us whose remembrance of 20th century critical movements, so is that New Historicism? No, that is...
No, New Criticism.
Is that close textual reading then?
Close textual reading, yeah. You don't really need to look beyond the text. The text will give you everything that you could ever need to know about it. And it's...
I wrote a blistering essay about that, in the Alberta or text. And you're like, oh, but language itself is an endlessly deferred series of signifiers.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But it develops from about the 1930s to about the 1950s. It's associated with Leavis, the critic. He kind of defines it.
So are we, having started this series by slagging off Ian Watt pretty comprehensively, is that a motor defence for him, is that he was in turn responding to a previous critical movement?
I mean, certainly of his time in that sense. I mean, how kind of, how much this was a project for him to write out or not deliberately to exclude, I don't know. I'd like to put in a word for 1986, if I can, at this point, because 1986 is kind of an exceptional year in this debate and in reclaiming the rise of the novel for women, because we have two books, The Mothers of the Novel, and we have The Rise of the Woman Novelist. Mothers of the Novel is a project that...
So that's Dale Spender's book,
Dale
isn't it?
Dale Spender's book.
And that looks at women writers before Jane Austen.
Yeah, she set herself the task of basically... She had noticed, where are all the women coming out of, I guess, the 70s consciousness-raising decade. She wondered, where are all the women? She set herself the task of reading about 550 novels. She didn't rate them all. She's quite upfront about that. But, for example, Ian Watt doesn't even mention Maria Edgeworth. And she's quite dry about this, and she says, well, the only reason I could think you wouldn't mention Maria Edgeworth is if you just hadn't read her.
Which is entirely, I would have thought, entirely possible, because that project of reclaiming women writers is something that, as you say, over the last 30 or 40 years has happened. It's still got quite a way to go, hasn't it? I mean, I remember reading about, you know, romantic women poets that were only now just really mm-hmm. interested, or
absolutely.
Tudor women poets, like, I'm going to say, Amelia Latimer.
Lanier. Yeah.
You know, that actually that people would have no idea that there were women mm-hmm. writing in, you know, or the female, the mystics of the Middle Ages. That project has had to be done throughout the whole of history. And this is what kind of irritates me when you get... I think I was in the Women's Hour quiz at Christmas, and they had a thing, a clip of Any Questions of Max Hastings saying in his Max Hastings voice, well, the thing is, the trouble is that these women just haven't done anything throughout history. And I just went, ah, at that point. But it's just not... Particularly when you look at the 18th century, you just cannot... Even Ian Watt in his superlatively cussing out way about... admits that they have quantitative dominance. There are lots of women there. Let's address the quality issue, though, because there are people who will argue it's a Darwinistic thing, like, you know, Tom Jones as a novel is just better than The New Atlantis.
I mean, I think there's a relatively easy way to tackle that, which is to ask why. You know, people like often this, you know, I'm staking my own critical colours to the mast here. I'm a historicist, you know, I'm not interested in saying one sort of literature is better than another. I'm interested in kind of looking at what literature can tell us about a historical moment, about power within that historical moment. But I have colleagues who, you know, will say, it's about aesthetic value. And the aesthetic value of, you know, a Shakespeare play is much greater than the aesthetic value of, you know, whatever else it might be. And yet they're never actually really able to tell you why. I think one of the most important things we can do as critics is to ask ourselves, why do we think what we say is good is good? Let's interrogate value itself and see where it comes from. Because otherwise, surely we're just treading a well-trodden path. And there's not actually anything very fun about that.
Well, that's something that I think about a lot when, in terms of now, and you get arguments about award ceremonies and diversity. Ian Leslie, one of our writers, wrote a brilliant piece for us last year about the Oscars, in which he was like, you know, the Oscars were, you know, the best for best film were American Sniper, which was like Warring Man. The one about drumming, which was like Drumming Man. The one about high school basketball, which was like, you know, Basketball Man. And it was Birdman, which eventually won, and, you know, which was like middle-aged crisising man. And it was just so obvious that these were just six heroes' journeys, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were no heroines' journeys there. And that's one of the main things where I think you begin to see... you begin to sort of think that certain subjects are more serious. I think that's
this
what it is.
Exactly. It's the
domestic, the feminine, you know, interpersonal relationships. There isn't the other bit of that quote is sort of talking about, well, of course, novels are very good at talking about, like, people's feelings, as if that's kind of like not what, you know, that's not a fit subject for
us. It's not important.
No.
This is the thing. I think when we start asking ourselves these questions about value, about why we think something is good, the answers are often quite uncomfortable. They're often bound up with ideas about gender, with ideas about race, with ideas about class. And it can be quite uncomfortable to scrutinise that.
And about public and private spheres, right?
Exactly.
So War and Peace is a better novel because it's about, quote unquote, big themes, you know, and that's what... I think this idea about that war is manly is really fascinating. They asked a whole load of historians in The Guardian last week about, you know, why don't women's history books sell as well?
Yeah.
And some of the... Simon Sharma gave a slightly irritating answer when he just named female historians that he knew. And you were like, yeah, okay, well, yeah, we all know that they exist. Why the question... Answer the question, Simon. Give that one an F. But Amanda Foreman's answer was interesting, when she said, you know, writing about the American Civil War, if you write women out of that story, you are not doing good history, because this was the first example of total war, you know, about blitzing a civilian population, about, you know, about raping women, about trying to crush people's morale. If you make it about men on battlefields, you've actually only written half the history.
Absolutely.
And I think that's something that you see in the way that the novel formation, you know, the formation of the canon around that has happened. If you write out these women, you are telling a bad history of the rise of the novel.
Mm-hmm.
There's a kind of conspiracy theory version of this too, which is a slightly darker version of the story, which says that actually we might have forgotten some of these women writers because men came alongside them, after them, and cherry-picked the best bits for themselves. That's another way in which we've lost these women, forgotten about them. Charlotte Smith is a really good example. She's a poet and a novelist. In terms of her poetry, William Wordsworth says she's a woman the English language knows, English literature, the English language knows much more, owes more to her than it will ever know. And that's basically because he's learned from her work. He's internalised the good bits, taken them for himself, and then moved on. Somebody like Dickens learns how to write a novel about the law from Charlotte Smith, again, unacknowledged. So there is this sense in which women's stories are there, and yet we're calling them something else.
Walter Scott, you know, the truism is that Walter Scott is the first historical novelist. No, he's not. The women who come, well, the historical novelists who come before him are mainly women. And he's quite upfront in some ways about what he's taken from them. Novelists like Jane West, like Charlotte Smith, he takes, you know, certain names from them. He takes, you know, lifts themes and images. But it's only very, very recently, thanks to the fantastic work of people like Stuart Curran, for example, that we're starting to see that, and to see that actually the fated, you know, much fated geniuses who have most frequently been men, actually it's built on this foundation of female intellect and female labour.
So there was a really interesting piece in, I think it was in the Literary Lit Hub, about by Siri Hustvedt, who's married to Paul Auster, so they're both novelists, about Karl Ove Knausgård, which we discussed on a New Statesman podcast previously, and about the difference between, you know, he is doing confessional writing, which has always been seen as this very feminine genre. You are kind of just sort of like going on about how you actually really slightly regret having children and, you know, the kind of mundanity of your life. But the trick is, because it's a man doing it, people are kind of like, oh, well, this is kind of... And I sometimes I feel a bit like that when I read Pamela or Clarissa. Pamela is, I know you don't believe in value judgments. I'm going to drop one here. Pamela is just it's no good. It's just no good. It's very clunky. People's dialogue is totally unbelievable. Although, admittedly, it's hard once you've read Shamala and the anti-Pamela and all the parodies of it, because it is, you know, you do get ye serving wench turns up and goes, Lork's a lady, you go, you know, I'm only a humble serving wench. But it's not very good. Clarissa, I would make an argument for, is much better. But those do seem, if someone now told me, actually, Samuel Richardson had published them on behalf of his wife and just put his name on them, I'd probably go, yeah, actually, I can really see that. But he gets to be Samuel Richardson, writing in an explicitly very feminine domestic romance setting, doesn't he?
And suddenly it's critically interesting and it's critically valid. Now, I think the same thing does go on today. I think if a woman writes about the breakdown of a relationship, then it's chick lit. If a man writes about the breakdown of a relationship, then it's a searing exposé of the American soul. You know, it's...
Yeah, I think Laurie had this great line. Laurie Penny, our writer, about, you know, men write memoirs. Mm. You know, they write literary journeys, and then but women write confessional literature. And I think there is really a difference in framing. Now, you've written a novel.
I have, yep.
How much did you end up feeling that there were gendered expectations about the subject, about the marketing of it, about you as an author? We should plug the novel. It's called Rights. It's available from all good bookshops, from Amazon, if you don't mind tax avoidance. I presume no one at any point went, she's put like a lovely, maybe like a woman on the phone, like a big pink heart on the cover.
Yeah, no, I was lucky, I think, in that my publisher and I agreed very much on what kind of a novel it was. They didn't want to drive it into a sort of niche that I felt it didn't fit. And the cover was extremely gender neutral. It was sort of a rainbow spun sort of title. I did get an interview to do some kind of an odd... I requested an odd kind of interview called Between the Sheets, which was for a TV channel that was somehow associated with Nuts magazine. I decided not to do that one. You know, that's an example of how, you know, one... you know, sort of, you're supposed to take up every irritation that you receive as a novelist.
Did you just think maybe these people are not my...
I thought they might not be audience. Legit somehow. I don't know. Maybe I was over suspicious.
Liz, I think that, it's interesting that Sophie mentions marketing, because so much of gendered expectations of literature now, I think, are about marketing, about the packaging up of authors and of books as a specific thing. How much did that happen? Because Richardson's an interesting example, isn't he? Because he was a printer, so he could do the mad papers in Clarissa because he could do crazy typography for himself. But most other women didn't have access to how they were marketed, how they were sold. How much did they get massaged into sort of figures by publishers and by printers?
Into figures?
You know, into the idea of like, being sold as kind of, you know, this... like Mrs. Meek, I presume. Yeah. There was a kind of character of Mrs. Meek that people sort of saw. Or, you know, the housewife superstar, or, you know, the young, you know, adventuress or whatever.
Yeah, I guess there's this whole kind of social world of novels that we don't think about that often when we read them as literary critics. I mean, Pamela is a good example in terms of being a phenomenon. You know, now you'd get your Pamela tea towel, or, you know, people ringing the bells to celebrate the wedding between Pamela and Mr. B, that kind of thing.
I think you'll find I wrote a really very seminal essay on on the links between Pamela and 50 Shades of Grey as literary phenomena. Because I think that, but I think that does stress it. And again, it maybe is about Samuel Richardson as a male author having that more prestige. Is it became a kind of literary phenomenon, didn't it? There were sort of Pamela fans that you can buy, and there was all kinds of, like, there was a lot of merch around that.
Some of these women are really incredibly famous in their own time, and we haven't mentioned Sidney Owenson, but she's one of the Irish novelists who comes after Mariah Edgeworth, and she takes that form of the Irish novel onto the next level, and it becomes a novel of nation, becomes a nationalistic form in her hands. She's arguing for the cause of Ireland under colonialism. And she becomes a real celebrity in a way that I think we'd recognise now. So she dresses up as figures from her novels. She markets the novel, I guess, through her own ability to perform her characters and her novel. And she's properly famous and yet completely forgotten. So she gets no mention in the rise of the novel stories until women come along, women academics, critics try to rebalance that story.
That's interesting, because I have never heard of her. And is that, I mean, do you think that partly there's that to do with being Irish, is that that's just, we still are so locked into actually English literary culture, yeah. And particularly in the way that it's taught in universities.
I mean, it could be, and that's why I've mentioned Hester Piozzi's Welsh perspective in an earlier episode, because that's been a very new development, that we're looking more to the margins, that we're looking to Scottish literature and Irish literature and seeing what women did there and seeing that actually at times it's quite different. So there could be a form of a political novel which is very different from the early 18th century, but which for somebody like Sidney Owenson was really, really successful. So 1806, The Wild Irish Girl, and she becomes then the figure of The Wild Irish Girl, Glorvina, from her own novel.
Are we quite London-centric in all of this that we've been discussing? So Charlotte Smith, presumably if Wordsworth was plundering her for stuff, was she a nature poet?
Yeah, she writes a lot about landscape. She's one of the first novelists to be really powerful writing about landscape in fiction. She sets her own poetry within the novels as well, so she's very innovative in that way. The poetry is very strong on landscape, seascape, beach scenes, that kind of thing. She's really powerful. And then Wordsworth comes along and learns how to do this.
And if we think about women novelists of the 19th century, Sophie, George Eliot, the Brontes, mm-hmm. How much would they have been conscious of their forebears? Because I've never had...
That's a really good question.
Jane Austen, I mean, obviously you can see the links between her and Burney and Edgeworth mm-hmm. writing that sort of... Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of Bildungsroman, really, I guess, a young woman's journey into the world and ending with a marriage.
Yeah.
But it's harder to see George Eliot in that tradition.
I was going to say that the elephant in the room was perhaps Jane Austen, that we hadn't mentioned Austen over the series too much, perhaps deliberately, because Austen is seen as the first great woman novelist and we're interested in, you know, kind of uncovering the...
That's because I just start quoting Lady Catherine de Bourgh. I've been thinking for a really long time that I just want to have only Lady Catherine de Bourgh quotes as my Twitter, like, insolent girl. And unfortunately, obviously, I'm now deeply influenced by the BBC, you know, where I just really want to kind of just go, boss, the shades of Pemberley be thus polluted in editorial meetings. But yeah, but that, I think that I've deliberately been trying to stay away from Jane Austen because I think the feeling is that she's too dominant, that people are kind of willing, like, she's the one that gets through, like, this is Smurfette syndrome, the idea that you're allowed one. She's the one. And we can all agree that Jane Austen was good.
Yeah.
Except, actually, we don't like Persuasion that much, and we don't like Mansfield Park. So, really, we're just talking about Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility.
Hey, I love Persuasion. I think the important thing is there's a common culture here. There's a common kind of literary inheritance. In the special collections at Cardiff University, which is where I work, there's a copy of Burney's Diaries and Letters, which is, you know, a multi-volume, expensively bound thing. And it's a mother who, there's an inscription in the flyleaf, which is, you know, it's a mother to her son in the 1860s. You know, this is an expensive gift. This is a personal family gift. She's still known. She's still going strong, even if there's been some kind of damage begun to be wrought on her reputation. So you ask about, you know, the Brontes, for example. The Brontes are well-read children. They've got access to, you know, whatever's lying around. But I don't see why that wouldn't have included some of these writers who still have a sort of cachet at that point. Charlotte Bronte is an avid reader of the Ladies' Magazine, which means that she shares a culture with somebody like Charlotte Smith, who wrote poetry for it in her teens. You know, so there's this, there is this shared culture between the women that we've been talking about, who have been, in a large sense, rather forgotten, and the ones who come later, who we can get an image of in our minds when we think of them, like Austen, like the Brontes on the Wuthering Moor, like George Eliot. There's common ground there, there's common culture.
And can you think of any female writers today who you feel are influenced by 18th century? I mean, I think of Hilary Mantel and A Place of Greater Safety. I mean, because it is a novel about the 18th century specifically, but about it, it's got, I mean, by God, it's big. But, you know, after modernism happened and after we began to have, you know, all the post-colonialism and all those kind of things, what, you know, is there an essence of the 18th century novel that you see anywhere today? I think you can still see ones, I would say someone like Jonathan Franzen, it feels almost kind of quite 19th century novel. They are those big kind of, aspiring to say a big thing. But do you see anybody who's doing anything that you think is influenced by the 18th century?
Well, in a narrow sense of content, there's a fantastic book by Beryl Bainbridge called According to Queenie, which is about Hester Thrale Piozzi and her family. So that's, you know, if anyone wants to kind of find out more about her, but in a literary imaginative sense, then that's a really good start. It's an excellent question about the form.
One person I did think of is Emma Donoghue wrote a collection of short stories, The Woman Who Gave Birth to Rabbits, which is different, and there's some Irish and some English, and those are based around real historical stories. So she's clearly somebody who knows that period quite well.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I could necessarily argue that Room is very, in any way, obviously influenced by the 18th century.
I'll go out on a limb and say in answer to your question, no. I think there's something we've lost, actually. Something quite, you know, it's difficult to sum up 18th century women's writing in one sort of sweep, and certainly as an academic you're discouraged from doing that. But, you know, there's something about, for me, the best 18th century novels that is rollicking and weird and bizarre and surreal. Frances Burney has this, you know, Evelina, we discussed it, it's a courtship novel. It's in some ways quite a novel that, you know, Austen riffs off. But also this monkey appears and starts biting everyone at the end for no apparent reason. But it's there, it's important. And, you know, there's all these kind of glimmers of something quite violent, savage and grotesque below the surface. It's very kind of exciting writing in that way, or I think it is. And yeah, I don't know, I don't think I can think of anything that does that today.
It makes me think about film and TV as well, and actually, I agree with you. I wonder if it might be that in some of the, you might even actually maybe see the legacies in what we probably, I don't know whether as practitioners would feel about us calling it chick lit, about courtship novels, and some of them can be really quite, you know, ambitious in their scope, but they're, because the market dictates that they get packaged up and sold as chick lit. I'm thinking of someone like Vary McFarlane, who I know, who's written very funny comic novels, and there is something of that. You know, that rollick, I think the rollick. But I agree with you that the combination of the sort of slight sauciness, the awareness of a world that's, you know, that's very mannered and very ordered, you know your place in it. I think that's the thing. It's harder maybe to be transgressive now because the boundaries themselves are so, I mean, we're so used to talking about, you know, liminal people and ideas of the queasiness that comes through Harriet Freke wearing trousers. You know, you just, it's, in a society that's much more pick and mix, it's kind of harder to recreate that feeling.
Can I also just say, next time someone's thinking, you know, someone with a great budget and whatever is thinking of making a TV adaptation, can you please not do Austen again? Please give Burney a chance. Do Evelina. It would be fantastic. You'd still get all the dancing scenes and the sexual tension, but you'd also get monkeys. It would be great. Give me a call.
Is that with the sacrace? Have I finally got the right one? Yes.
You'd have the old woman sacrace.
Which is really weird and horrible and violent. Like the idea of a loaded group of really posh people standing around watching toothless old crones sort of fight,
but it's a perfect metaphor for the way in which age and experience in a woman is just absolutely, you know, knocked about and beaten to a bloody pulp in that society. It works.
Okay.
And it can be so marvellous.
Liz, if you've got a nomination for what you want, the, you know, what if Emma Thompson's listening, what would I like her to adapt into a film?
Some of the novels are pretty clunky, and she wrote them really fast for money, and she wrapped them up really kind of strangely, sometimes unsatisfyingly at the end. But I would love to see something by Charlotte Smith, just because I would love to see people read Charlotte Smith. I would love to see kind of cheap, accessible paperbacks, you know, Oxford World's Classics, Penguin, if you're listening, that kind of, we would love to have Charlotte Smith, these novels of ideas, these amazing stories of kind of women's struggles. It would be anything by Charlotte Smith in a new edition.
See, I'm in a fortunate position because one of my favourite writers from the end of that period, Anne Lister, they did make a BBC Four, you know, great lesbianism in the coal fields.
Yeah.
I mean, what's not to love about that?
Brilliant.
So before we go, this is the end of our 6 episodes. We've wearily crossed the finish line of the incredibly long 18th century. Have either of you missed a chance to tell a really dirty anecdote?
Absolutely not.
I think then I feel that we can retire from the battlefield.
Liz has told the story.
I've done mine.
Okay, well, maybe we can like that can be a teaser for you know, if we do another series, that there'll be 100% more rude anecdotes. But thank you so much to both of you, and thank you to all our contributors to this series. And you can read about the show notes. We'll put about recommendations for things to read. And if you're listening, do please reissue some nice paperbacks and make a glossy Hollywood film.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You've been listening to the New Statesman's History Podcast, Hidden Histories, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by India Burke. Our music is Jean-Baptiste Lully's Gavotte, performed by Thrax, and is licensed under Creative Commons. For more information about the writers and works discussed in this programme, visit newstatesman.com/podcast.